This is Audible.
Audible Originals presents One Fine Fae, written by Molly Harper, performed by Jonathan Davis and Amanda Ronconi.
One. Charlotte. Charlotte McBee was accustomed to the incredulous look she got while driving her oversized Airstream trailer down the highway. Nobody expected the silver stork. But had she known about the wedding taking place in Mystic Bayou's town square, she probably would have taken another route. Charlotte slumped in the seat of her truck, practically folding her small frame into the space under the steering wheel, as hundreds of eyes followed the silver stork's progress down Main Street. It wasn't that Charlotte was embarrassed of her beautiful, bewheeled darling, but she'd seen enough wedding reality shows to know that distracting guests from the bride could end in violence. And Charlotte had been driving for too long to put up much of a fight. Charlotte thought she could park near the League office complex, but then realized that the collection of temporary buildings that housed their offices and employees was on the opposite side of the square, directly behind the wedding party. So she just eased down the street to the Mystic Bayou Parish Hall and parked across multiple spots. The town proper was like so many rural small towns where she'd worked in her 10 years as a midwife, consulting for the International League for Interspecies Cooperation. One main street that included most of the town's businesses and municipal buildings, branching out into a tree of residential streets with small, one-level houses. She imagined that most of the locals lived in the dense swamplands that surrounded this tiny spot of civilization. Charlotte hopped out of the truck, groaning in relief as she stretched her legs, short as they were. Most of the wedding guests seemed to have stopped staring and returned to their merriment. According to her official league welcome email, she was supposed to talk to an A.J. Lancaster, the executive director of the league's operation here in town. She pulled her fancy satellite smartphone from her pocket, an essential when the league sent her to some of the most remote locations in the continental United States. She dialed Lancaster's cell phone number, but he didn't pick up. She glanced up and down Main Street, wondering whether there was some place she could grab something to eat. Most of the businesses, small, single-story cement block affairs, seemed to be owned by a boon. The local bank, a boat dealership, the grocery store, the beauty salon, the hardware store. All of their signs practically shouted, "Boon!" The only eateries seemed to be a gray and navy building called the Ice Cream Depot and Bathilda's Pie Shop, home of the world's best chocolate rhubarb pie, both of which were closed. She paused, chewing her lip in disappointed distress. After a long day of driving, she'd really been looking forward to something that she hadn't cobbled together herself in her kitchenette. And it didn't help that the wedding party seemed to center around some sort of meat-laden fire pit. The smoke wafting across the square smelled like absolute heaven. "Hello!" Charlotte turned to see a man in a dark, bespoke suit, all broad shoulders and dark blonde hair, walking briskly towards her. He looked like a central casting version of an upwardly mobile prosecutor. She hoped desperately that she hadn't violated some archaic local parking law. She didn't have time to serve in the local... Wait, did they have a local jail here? She didn't see one. "Hi there. Are you Charlotte McBee by any chance?" Mr. Upwardly Mobile asked, extending his hand for a shake. "I am." The man grinned broadly. "I'm A.J. Lancaster. The head office said you'd wrapped up your previous assignment early and should be arriving in town this weekend," he said. A.J. Lancaster, the league's new executive director of the Mystic Bayou Project. Her boss. And she didn't think she'd combed her unruly hair since driving through Arkansas. It was possible to sigh inside her own head, right? "They told you about the silver stork, didn't they?" she said, cringing slightly as she shook his hand. "They did say it would make you easy to spot," which it did, he said brightly. gesturing towards the gathering of people who were pretending they weren't watching the exchange.
Are you hungry? We could get you fed while you're introduced to everybody.
Oh, I would hate to intrude, she said, shaking her head. The happy couple aren't expecting me, and I couldn't just join in. It's bad manners.
Actually, the bride is one of your prospective patients, and one of your supervisors. Besides, Jillian's been on edge, waiting for you to get into town. If she knew who you were, she'd probably drag you across the square herself. He paused and shuddered. Actually, come to think of it, I think I could be in a lot of trouble if I didn't introduce you. She took off Adam McTeague's eyebrows the other day when he tried to talk over a scheduled bathroom break during a committee meeting. Pregnant phoenixes are dangerous in ways I did not expect.
Well, if you put it that way, she sighed, glancing down at her cotton shorts and jean jacket. Should I change?
Jillian won't care what you're wearing. She knows you're here to help her, he said,
offering her his elbow like some Austenian hero.
We're really relieved to have someone of your skill set joining us. We have Dr. Carmody running the clinic, but with predicted local population growth after the incident, our mathematicians are also predicting a considerable spike in pregnancies over the next few years.
Any league employee hearing the word incident could only think of one monumental event in the supernatural community over the last few months. A Louisville man named Eustace Cornwell, a satyr whose family was the basis for the Popelick monster legend, lost an argument over a parking space and shifted in front of dozens of people. Most of those people had smartphones and YouTube accounts. It was simply too much exposure for the league to cover up. Humanity was informed that the nightmares that used to keep them shivering under thatched roofs at night, from fairies to sea monsters, it was all real. Real and secretly living beside them since time immemorial. And now the truth was out. Humanity as a whole did not handle this well. There was a massive wave of protests, petitions, and inaccurate Facebook posts that had some humans believing that supernatural creatures had been plotting for years to take over the world, as opposed to slowly being pushed out of all their natural spaces by the far larger human population. Watching politicians arguing on the news over whether supernatural should have to sign up for some sort of registry, Charlotte wondered if it would have been easier if humans found out that one mythological creature existed at a time. The league could announce one a week. Unicorns are real, but most of them are very cranky and definitely don't try to tickle them. And then the next week, okay, mermaids too. She thought maybe it would have been kinder to slowly introduce the concept as opposed to ripping off the monster band-aid all at once. Fortunately, the league had been preparing for this eventuality for years. They circulated millions of free copies of a book written by Jillian Ramsey, PhD, while she lived in Mystic Bayou, where humans and Majik, the local umbrella term for all supernatural types, had lived in harmony for generations. The Bayou, a wholehearted approach to a blended community, was a slightly altered version of a manual Dr. Ramsey had written for league officials, explaining how the two populations of the, name-redacted, Bayou managed to do just that, with minimal violence, while mingling their cultures and bloodlines. Dr. Ramsey had gone on the news and talk show circuit, explaining how absolutely normal the lives of most Majik were, that humans had likely lived next door to Majik for years and come to no harm. So it stood to reason that they would continue to be fine. And perhaps losing their shit on a worldwide scale was a little premature. The whole mess was unnerving. But somehow, as AJ led her through the crowd, Charlotte couldn't help but feel it was a distant problem, far from this place. The lively accordion-heavy music, bright and happy, churned over the chatter and laughter. Bottles in every conceivable color of glass hung from the tree branches overhead, and she thought she saw tiny lights glowing inside of them. It was difficult to tell in the golden afternoon light. Cheerful, homespun floral arrangements practically dripped from every stationary surface. Small round tables placed sporadically around the square groaned under the weight of the guests' heaped plates. People were happy here, celebrating the union of two of their own, eating and drinking and dancing, as if the world outside wasn't going completely bonkers. And it was a relief to feel like she was a tiny part of it. So how dramatic of a population increase are we talking here?
Well, we've had about 40 outsiders move here since the incident. It doesn't sound like much, but it's about 40 times the normal number of people who choose to move here in an average year. Aside from league employees who have been assigned to the bayou, that is. There are no rental properties to be had in town. Most of them are living in an impromptu RV park on the end of Main Street. We have good reason to believe that's not going to slow down.
Charlotte hummed in agreement. Since the release of Jillian's book, humans seem to think that name-redacted bayou was a sort of supernatural Disneyland, where they could find answers for all of the universe's big questions, or just live out their lifelong dream of seeing a Sasquatch. And supernatural creatures saw it as a chance to settle into the sort of life they'd always dreamed of, accepted and normal, and living with people who understood their unique situations. Most of the changes the League made to the public version of the book were aimed at protecting the anonymity of the town and its residents, but, well, the internet existed. Frankly, Charlotte was surprised the town wasn't overrun. She spotted the bridal couple, posing for a wedding party portrait in front of a carved stone fountain. The fountain featured an assortment of mythical creatures, sheltered under the wings of a dragon. Jillian was wearing a long-sleeved white lace dress with an empire waist that only served to emphasize the curve of her belly, which she was happily stroking. The bridesmaids were wearing white dresses remarkably similar to Jillian's, though their flower crowns were less ornate. The groom was a tall, lean man, hovering over Jillian with an expression that seemed equal parts joy and anxiety. Charlotte supposed she couldn't blame him. Dr. Ramsey had a very busy couple of months recently, under intense media scrutiny. Her assurances, written and verbal, had done quite a bit to quell the public post-Popelick monster panic. The headlines became less apocalyptic. The social media posts became marginally more reasonable. Market stabilized. Charlotte had an enormous amount of respect for Jillian, particularly the icy dignity with which she testified before Congress, while very politely telling them that proposing registries to deal with the Majik instead of, say, having a conversation with said Majik was an act of self-destructive incompetence. Like Jillian, who had also used that same glacial gravitas to inform the political types that it was none of their business what sort of Maji she was, Charlotte's family had elected not to publicly announce that Charlotte and her mother Lizzie were a type of Romanian fae called Zana. Not because the McBees were afraid of being hurt, but because they were afraid that Lizzie's patients and their families would decide they didn't want to be treated by a Maji. In a location as secluded and remote as Waller Forge, Tennessee, that could be dangerous for pregnant women, human or Maji. Compared to a lot of modern fae she knew, Charlotte had enjoyed a relatively idyllic childhood. Stable, living in one place, with both parents. Her mother was a midwife, as were her ancestors, all the way down the line back to the old country, before deforestation drove them across the Atlantic. Her granny's services were so in demand in baby-booming Appalachia, people didn't ask a lot of questions. They just wanted their babies born safe and healthy. Charlotte was fortunate that there was enough human blood in her line that she didn't have the typical fae metal allergies or the strange spinal abnormalities, also known as wings. Lizzie McBee saw it as the family duty to provide humans with a peaceful, safe path into the world. She delighted in bestowing lifelong gifts on babies. Charlotte saw it as a heap of pressure. What if she picked the wrong gift? What if the child was meant to be a world-saving scientist and Charlotte gave her a beautiful singing voice? Which was nice and all, but so was a cure for cancer. So, Charlotte tried to give the babies the gifts they would need in this strange, turbulent world. Courage, strength, determination, the ability to know when to abstain from social media. Let other fairies worry about temporary things like beauty and talent. You've stumbled into the best possible way to be introduced to all of the movers and shakers here in town, AJ told her, He pointed to the radiant blonde bride. That's obviously Jillian, author of this year's most read book, and our official liaison between locals and the League, and sometimes the rest of the world. That's her new husband, Bael Boone. He's a dragon shifter, the local sheriff, and related to half of the business owners in town. But his family is a sore subject, and you definitely don't want to bring it up. The tall guy with the beard, who looks like a biker gang and a superhero franchise had a terrifying baby, that's Mayor Zed Barand. He is very protective of, well, everybody. But the whole wedding party in particular. And he can turn into a giant bear, so it's best not to bring out that protective side. The maid of honor there, standing right next to the bride, that's Sonia Fong, the director of operations. She's the real power around here, the one who keeps us running. I just have the title. Her maid is Will Carmody, the other groomsman, and our local doctor. The pretty brunette, laughing at the mayor, Danica Teal, an energy manipulator doing research on atmospheric anomalies, and the love of Zed's life. That is a lot to remember, she sighed, watching as the bridal party joked and jostled each other around with practiced ease. I have a chart at home with profile pictures, he whispered. I keep it taped to the back of my closet door. I'll make you a copy if you promise not to tell anybody. It covers every major player in town, including the mamas who will feed you into submission. I will memorize it and then burn it, she promised, making him chuckle. Instead of a traditional wedding cake, the happy couple had elected to have an enormous tower of pies arranged on a custom-made display with dozens of tiered supports. It looked mismatched and delicious, guarded by a tiny brownie whose scowling face was nearly covered by her enormous pinned corsage. Bael and Jillian carefully fed each other a slice of some sort of chocolate pie. Charlotte noticed that no one encouraged them to smash the pie into each other's faces, which she appreciated. In the hubbub of people claiming their pie slices, AJ called the bridal couple over. If Jillian was confused by a complete stranger showing up at her wedding reception, she didn't show it, simply smiling and kissing Charlotte's cheek when AJ introduced her. Sorry, I'm just flying a little high on all the nuptial joy. She giggled when Charlotte seemed surprised. This is Charlotte McBee, the midwife we talked about, AJ said. If Charlotte had been surprised by the cheek kiss, she was stunned by lean, lethal-looking Bael throwing his muscled arms around her shoulders and hugging her like his life depended on it.
Oh, thank goodness.
Dragons were possessive and dangerously protective of pregnant mates. And yet this man was hugging her?
I'm just so glad you're here,
Bael said, still hugging Charlotte.
She's got a giant metal egg inside her. Please help.
Jillian shook her head, bemused.
Bael's a little overwhelmed by the idea of how the egg is going to get out.
We'll figure that out just as soon as possible, Charlotte promised him, turning to Jillian.
You're my priority case, according to Miss Hayashi.
Because I'm a League employee?
Jillian asked, frowning.
No, because we don't have any Dragon Phoenix pregnancies on record.
And Miss Hayashi really likes you, Charlotte said. She knows how hard you've been working and wants to make sure you're taken care of.
Aw, I'm still getting used to the idea that she knows my name.
Jillian sighed, her eyes getting misty. Charlotte chuckled.
Well, obviously you're pretty busy right now. But how soon would you like to have an exam? I'm assuming you're having a honeymoon of some sort.
Jillian sniffed and waved her hand in front of her eyes to ward off the oncoming tears.
Yes, I won't be able to help you acclimate to your new job, as I will be on a brief honeymoon in a cabin in the middle of nowhere that Bael will not give anyone coordinates for in fear that people will track us down and tell us all about their problems.
It tends to happen a lot,
Bael muttered, having finally let go of Charlotte. Jillian added,
followed by being sequestered until I give birth.
Well, I'll be with you the whole time, so at least you won't be lonely. This is my cell phone number. If you have any problems at all, you call me. Doesn't matter how minor you think it is or how silly you feel, you call me.
Jillian wrapped her arms around Charlotte's shoulders. Thank you. You seem nice. I almost hate to tell you that the confinement will be in a cave in the middle of nowhere, also in a place Bael will not provide coordinates for,
Charlotte snickered.
I once helped a Yeti give birth inside a glacier. I can handle it.
In the meantime, Dr. Carmody will be able to answer all of your questions and help you figure out a patient list, Jillian said. To be honest, we don't know how long we're going to need you. With all the people coupling up lately, it would seem like it could be a while. The baby betting pool on Sonia versus Danny has been vicious.
That offends a lot of my sensibilities, Sonia muttered.
Noted, but I can't do anything about it, Jillian told her.
Before Charlotte could respond, there was a commotion by the pie stand. A tall man with almost cultishly long limbs tripped, almost falling face first into the tower of pastries. Suddenly, the burly mayor, Zed, was behind him, catching him by the elbows, stopping his momentum so effectively that he only bumped the stand a little bit. Sonia ran over and steadied the tower and adjusted the few pies that had been jostled back into place.
As Zed set the man back on his feet, Charlotte felt a zing of awareness up her spine. Somewhere nearby, the consequences of fairy magic were rippling over the air. Zed curved an enormous hand around the poor man's shoulder.
Leonard, buddy, I like you, but don't endanger the pie.
Leonard sighed.
Thanks, man.
Charlotte took a closer look at Leonard. At first glance, the man didn't have the magnetic pull of smoldering Zed or elegant Bayel, but he had a kind face, warm brown eyes and sandy hair, square jaw, a narrow, well-formed nose, and a sensitive mouth. But there was something off about him. He radiated a chaotic energy that was mismatched with his body. She paused, watching him. Was this poor man cursed? Charlotte made a mental note to ask about this later. Today was not a day for fairy business. It was for making good impressions and getting some of that pie.
Poor Leonard, Jillian sighed. I told him not to get so wound up about making sure the buffet was timed right. People don't starve here in Mystic Bayou. The mamas wouldn't allow it.
AJ patted Charlotte's arm.
Speaking of which, I'm sure you're hungry after all that time on the road, Charlotte. How about I get you a plate?
Oh, I couldn't.
Charlotte's brows lifted. Was this how her boss treated all new hires? Fetching them pie? If they put that sort of thing on the brochure, there would be no recruitment problems at the league. If the league did recruitment brochures, which they did not. You spend a lot of time telling me what you couldn't do.
I hope that's not a sign of what us working together will be like,
AJ said, winking at her.
It's nonsense. You've been driving all day. I don't mind. Any allergies I should know about?
Pushy supervisors? She suggested.
I'm giving you the spicy gumbo, just for that, he told her, turning towards a long table set with what looked like hundreds of dishes.
Welcome to the bayou,
a voice boomed to Charlotte's left, making her jump. She turned to find Zed standing behind her, offering her a plate of some strange chocolate and fruit concoction. The thick chocolate filling oozed with pink chunks of celery?
That there is a chocolate rhubarb pie, a local specialty,
Zed informed her, smiling broadly.
Oh, thanks, Mr. Mayor. You didn't have to do that.
Sure I did. You're here to take care of our Jillian and who knows who else. We've got a bayou baby boom coming down the tracks at us. We want to make sure you feel at home.
When Charlotte paused mid-reach for the plate and sent him a curious look, Zed added,
Bear hearing is better than people think. Siobhan's a little busy to help you pick your pie, but I figured most people like chocolate.
Do I look so tired that I can't pick my own pie?
Charlotte asked. Jillian laughed.
Siobhan is a brownie, and she has this strange ability not only to make amazing pies, but to choose the best pie to meet your spiritual and emotional needs. It's a thing here. And believe it or not, you won't be disappointed. Her chocolate rhubarb is magical, either way. You can't lose.
Any pie would meet my spiritual and emotional needs right now. Charlotte sighed, shoveling a bite into her mouth. She put down her fork and leveled a very serious look at Jillian.
I need to find Siobhan and give her all of my money.
That's how most people respond, Jillian said, patting her arm.
AJ hadn't been kidding about the number of mamas who would press food on her. Before she could sit down with the enormous platter of shrimp, rice dressing, crawfish bread, boudin, cornbread, and weirdly enough, spetzel, a half dozen or so mothers sailed by to pile more food on her plate. "They're scoping you out as a potential mate for their sons," Sonia informed her, placing an ice-cold beer bottle by Charlotte's plate and settling into the chair next to her. Charlotte wasn't sure whether her sudden paralysis was from being starstruck by so many league luminaries sitting at the table with her, or from the announcement that she was about to be aggressively matchmade. She'd been through this before, her trailer door getting knocked on constantly as her little mini-fridge filled with not entirely edible casseroles. Convincing the masses of interfering parents, most of them trying to launch their adult sons out of their houses, that she did not, in fact, want to take said sons off of their hands, had a tendency to interfere with her job. Apparently sensing her distress, Sonia added, "It's nothing personal. It happens every time a newcomer moves into town. So far, all of the league transplants have found partners here and settled down. The mamas see it as a way to secure their kids' lives here in town and a couple of grandkids." Charlotte pressed her lips together and tried to find the most diplomatic way of saying, "Please, no."
"They probably stocked your fridge already," Zed told her. "I don't think I've ever seen my maman without Tupperware in her car."
"But the trailer is locked," Charlotte objected. Zed grinned at her.
"It's cute that you think locks will keep them out."
Charlotte shook her head. "I don't like that."
"Can't say I blame you," Sonia assured her.
"The social rules down here are a little different. Jillian and Bayel had to post the invitation on the community billboard because you exclude one person and there will be a reckoning, either magically or socially. If we hadn't put Clarissa in charge of the food, I don't know if we would have had any idea what to do. But despite my catering ineptitude, if you have any questions about anyone or anything, I am your point person. Because if Will doesn't know, I'll know." "Meanwhile, I'll be in a cave somewhere," Jillian muttered. Sonia grinned at her and wrapped her arm around her shoulders. "Bayel wants you to have a chance to rest, sweetie. Not to mention some post-wedding privacy. Take advantage. Trust me and Leonard to keep things running while you're gone. You'll be back bossing us around in no time."
"It's not that I don't trust you. It's that I don't like missing out on things," Jillian replied poutily, making Sonia laugh. "It takes weeks for me to catch up."
At the mention of Leonard, the pie endangerer, Charlotte scanned the crowd for Leonard. Something about that skittering sensation of fairy magic up her spine in the middle of a wedding reception made her incredibly uneasy. She looked for him among the smiling, laughing faces, celebrating a couple so clearly on their way to a bright and happy future. But he was gone.
2. Leonard. When you nearly take out your boss's de facto wedding cake because of a fairy curse, surely your next day at work had to be easier by comparison, right? Leonard O'Donnell had been prepared for something to happen at Jillian's wedding. Even though he had no direct role in the ceremony, being around that many people in dress clothes with the emotional stakes so high, he knew the jitters would get the best of him and disaster would follow. He hadn't expected to trip and come dangerously close to toppling Siobhan's masterwork of pie. But with the curse, you never really knew what was going to happen on big occasions for O'Donnell's. His poor cousin Shannon had dropped her groom's wedding ring during the ceremony, then knocked a candelabra over when she bent to pick it up and set her gown on fire. If not for a quick-thinking flower girl who doused her in holy water, Shannon would have spent her honeymoon in the ER. The O'Donnell curse was no laughing matter. A whole family of people who got more clumsy as they got more nervous. Fortunately, Zed had caught Leonard before he did too much damage to the pies. He adored Jillian, who had been accepting and understanding of his condition from the moment he was hired as her executive assistant. Knowing that he could potentially do much worse before the bouquet toss, he'd given the bride his best wishes and gotten the hell out of Dodge. It was what was best for everybody. But then, Monday morning, he walked into the administrative building to find that Jessica Galanis tried to pull a power move the minute Jillian was officially on her honeymoon and was moving Leonard's desk to the annex. Despite the fact that La Fae, a mystical rip in the fabric of the universe that had, until recently, threatened to unravel and unleash its body-altering energy into southern Louisiana and beyond, had closed, Mystic Bayou still offered a wealth of research opportunities in areas like genetics, meteorology, economics, for the League. Rather than closing up shop, the League was expanding its interest in the Bayou with a permanent administrative building research center. Unfortunately, construction on that center wouldn't begin until late spring. The annex was technically a temporary extension of the administrative trailer, tacked on to give Sonia and Jillian room to work after AJ had taken over Jillian's position. AJ was smart enough not to move Jillian too far away from Sonia, not just because they'd been close friends for years, but because together they made minor miracles happen. The same awareness could not be contributed to Jessica, Leonard's nemesis. He knew it wasn't normal for an executive assistant to have an arch enemy. His job centered on managing Sonia and Jillian's schedules and workload. Jessica was AJ's assistant and was supposed to be focused on him. Unlike nearly every other job in the Bayou, their positions were not fraught with peril. And yet, Jessica fought for domination of that trailer like it was her own personal kingdom and he was a usurper. She didn't like that his was the first face people saw when they walked in, while she was seated closer to AJ's door, facing the wall. She didn't like that he was considered the gatekeeper to not only Sonia and Jillian, but AJ as well. She didn't like that she'd gone to a university to study how to best optimize an executive's workflow and schedule, while Leonard had just fallen into the job. Leonard thought that maybe they could have bonded, both being cursed because of the actions of an ancient ancestor, but no. Jessica seemed to think that being a direct descendant of King Midas made her some sort of magic elite. Literally, everything she touched turned to gold. She'd actually helped the League out a few times when they'd foreseen budget shortfalls in the 2008 financial crisis, turning a few old vehicles to gold so they could be melted down into capital for the League. By comparison, Leonard was just an oaf who bumped into things. His only comfort was that the curse prevented Jessica from enjoying the fruits of her abilities, which he supposed was the definition of a curse. The stories about Midas emphasized his inability to eat or drink, but they didn't mention anything about the gold disappearing from Midas's hands when he tried to spend it. Jessica could help other people, or secret government agencies, but if she tried to hand her gold to someone in exchange for goods or services, it would fade into nothing. Her family had sent banks all over the world into a state of panic over the years, depositing huge piles of gold bricks, only for the vaults to be empty the next day and their accounts returned to their previous balance. Apparently, it was meant to teach Midas and his bloodline about selfishness and helping others. Magic could be a real pain in the ass sometimes. Jessica was certainly imperious as Leonard spun around in the lobby like a doofus, trying to figure out where his desk had moved over the weekend. Any evidence that he'd ever worked there had disappeared and was replaced with Jessica's strange round work module based on some Swedish principle of open workflow and clutter destruction. She settled her long-legged frame in her module, swishing her long, sable-colored ponytail over the shoulder of her designer jacket. She dressed to impress, but somehow lacked the elegance that Sonia managed to exude so easily. Don't bother getting comfortable, she'd told him, shooting the cuffs of the prim white leather driving gloves she wore to keep her hands from goldening everything she touched. I took the liberty of having your desk moved to the annex. It just makes more sense as Jillian's duties become more limited. I'm sure this has nothing to do with the fact that Jillian's out of the office, he deadpanned. I don't know what you mean, she said, smiling blithely as she entered her password into her computer. What's next? You're going to try to call a meeting of department heads without Jillian? Try to stage a one-woman coup over the coffee supplies? If you have a problem with the way I organize the office, you can always complain to the head administrator. You're the head administrator. Jessica's lips curled into a smirk. Yes, I know. Sonia walked into the office, three binders stacked in her arms, her sleek brow lifted at the appearance of secretarial turmoil. What is happening here? All appearances of smirking on Jessica's face made way for an expression of sweetness and light. Oh, just a little reorganization, streamlining operations, moving the fluff out of the way. Sonia, who had been a much better head administrator before being promoted to director of operations, frowned. Jessica, I believe we had a conversation where we discussed not referring to our colleagues as fluff. Jessica's shrug was more of a wiggle of the shoulders, as if insulting Leonard wasn't worth the full gesture. Well, Sonia, change is necessary as we enter this new era for the Mystic Bayou facility. And we both know how difficult it is for people to accept change. Sometimes you just have to guide them through it. Leonard did not appreciate being talked about like he wasn't present, or smart enough to understand the conversation. I'm just trying to maximize the potential of the space while reducing confusion about our roles. Sonia smiled patiently. Jessica, you know I appreciate proactivity, but you don't have the authority to make those decisions. The system that we've had in place for weeks works quite well, thank you. Please put the desk back where it was. But Mr. Lancaster gave me the I will discuss this with Mr. Lancaster. Put it back, please. Sonia's smile was just as cool as Jessica's, though there was underlying bite in her voice as she added, Now, Leonard, if you could join me in my office. He tried not to sneer at Jessica as he followed Sonia into her office. He really did. She sighed as she rounded the ever-growing display of plants that bloomed around her desk. Leonard flopped into the guest chair. Thanks, Sonia. Think nothing of it, she said, waving his gratitude away as if knocking the wind out of the office bully's sails was nothing. Some people become administrators because they enjoy controlling small worlds in a universe that is pure chaos. Sonia laid a slim, elegant hand against her delicate peach silk blouse. Other people become administrators because they like pushing people around, she added. I haven't decided which Jessica is, but I hope she's just trying to justify why her position is vital to the organization. I'm trying to be patient with her, but no matter what, I've got your back, Len. You were here first, and you are far less annoying. Thanks, Sonia. Leonard pulled his phone out, and they spent a few minutes reviewing her schedule, unanswered emails, and the duties they would be expected to cover during Jillian's honeymoon and maternity leave. Leonard's position would be more forward-facing, as he would be recording locals' concerns. Honestly, Leonard was sort of looking forward to it. He liked the vast majority of the Mystic Bayou residents he'd met. They were strange and fascinating people, with even weirder backgrounds than his own. It was the only place he'd ever lived where he could be honest about his life and be completely accepted. All he had to say was, fairy curse, and people just nodded and moved along with their business. I know it's going to be demanding for you, but I'm confident you can handle it, Sonia told him. Now, if you'll join me at the clinic, we have a new midwife to initiate into the ways of Mystic Bayou. Jillian's midwife is here? Leonard exclaimed. For weeks, Jillian had been talking about the specialist with extensive experience in rare hybrid pregnancies, as if this Charlotte woman was a golden lifeline. How did I miss that? She got here right before the pie stand thing, Sonia said gently. Well, hell, he sighed. But it's just the normal new employee, please don't do anything evil meet and greet, right? Do you really need me for that? Not really. But it means Jessica will have to figure out how to move your desk on her own. That sounds just fair enough to be properly vengeful, he said, standing and gesturing grandly towards the door. Lead the way. Jessica was still trying to get maintenance workers to come help her move Leonard's enormous workstation back as they left. Leonard figured that was justice. There weren't a lot of advantages of living in a place as small as Mystic Bayou. There were no chain stores or Starbucks or even a bar. But he could walk basically anywhere in town from his office door, or his trailer door, which happened to be about 300 feet from his office door. He hadn't bought gas since he moved to town. They walked across the street to the clinic, past the giant silver Airstream that had sort of appeared during the wedding reception. The site featured a highly stylized white bird over swooping lettering that read, "The Silver Stork." That was different. The clinic was technically an old veterinary hospital that Sonia had almost single-handedly converted to treat people so the town could have a doctor again. And that doctor happened to be Will Carmody, a Bayou-born physician who happened to be Sonia's boyfriend. And he happened to be a mermaid, sort of. Leonard wasn't sure how that worked, but honestly, he was afraid to ask. Well, love of my life, Sonia called, walking through the brightly painted waiting room. I'm here with Leonard. Will's ridiculously handsome face appeared in his office door, a brilliantly white smile blooming at the sight of Sonia. Living in the bayou could really wear on the old self-esteem when you were just a regular-looking guy. Not to mention those magazine-perfect-looking guys could also turn into dragons and tigers and, honest-to-God, bears. But Will was a nice guy, and he made Sonia happy. And he'd thought to include Leonard in a couple of dude gatherings with Bale and Zed, which was pretty cool of him. Hey there, sweetheart, Will purred, kissing her in what could be considered a professional manner. Just in time. I made coffee. That's why you're my favorite, she told him, as Will waved them into the office. I was just reviewing some cases for Charlotte. As he was walking through the door, Leonard dropped the binders he was holding. He was stepping forward as he did this, and his foot connected, kicking the binders across the floor and under Will's desk. Because, of course, he did. Charlotte was the most beautiful thing he'd ever seen. Huge, thickly lashed eyes the color of the summer sky seemed to dominate a delicate heart-shaped face. Her lush mouth was painted a blushing pink. He would happily spend hours contemplating if she wouldn't find that sort of thing creepy. Her thick, dark curls were pulled back from her face in a neat twist at the crown of her head, a compliment to the crisp blue scrubs she wore. And she was so small. He'd never seen someone so proportionately petite outside of the Tinkerbell cartoons his nieces loved. How was it possible to fit so much into one tiny package? No, don't call women things. His brain chided him. You know better than that. But all other cognitive functions were just gone. His brain had abandoned him. Blood rushed to his cheeks, and he felt the familiar rush of anxiety that was almost always followed by disaster and broken glass and, once, the destruction of a life-size fiberglass blue whale at a natural history museum. He focused on the breathing exercise his mother had taught him, focusing his rampant thoughts and slowing his heart rate. He thought of the forest near his parents' weekend cabin, deep and green and shadowed. He thought of the music of the river behind the cabin, the water dancing over the moss-covered rocks. The forest had been his happy place as a child, unlike the classmates who had been warned never to wander out of their sterile, safe suburb. The more he calmed his nerves, the less the curse would affect him, and the fewer whale replicas would suffer. Will eyed Leonard, but having reviewed Leonard's case extensively, said nothing beyond, "I'll get those." Leonard cleared his throat. Hi, he said, walking across the room like it was a damn tightrope, just so he could shake her hand. Leonard O'Donnell, nice to meet you.
Charlotte McBee.
A strange spark, like blue lightning, crackled between their hands. Charlotte yelped, her eyes going ever wider as she shook off the shock. She giggled, a bell-like noise that did strange things to Leonard's pulse. Somehow his cheeks grew hotter and he backed away, sitting in his chair before he could do any more harm. "Sorry about that," he muttered. She smiled sweetly and he felt his heart break just a little in its warmth.
"No problem. Static electricity."
Leonard made a noise that was somehow both squeaky and grumbling. Could he belly crawl out of the room? It seemed like the option least likely to result in injury to others or further embarrassment to himself.
"So I know we probably overwhelmed you a little bit at the wedding. We're just so happy you're here."
Sonia handed Charlotte a bright blue Welcome to League Employment in the Mystic Bayou office binder and a League copy of Jillian's book.
"This is a brief overview of Bayou-specific policies, and just in case you haven't read it, Jillian's History of the Bayou, La Fay, and the League's involvement here."
Charlotte nodded, recently having learned about La Fay, the interdimensional rift located in the swamp that was responsible for Mystic Bayou's supernatural population. Over the years, it had either drawn shifters and fae to Mystic Bayou or changed human residents at a genetic level, turning them into magic. According to the League's officials who requested her presence here, the rift had recently been closed. But before that had happened, it had been a beacon for supernatural creatures of all kinds. Charlotte looked at the book and nodded.
"We know it's a lot," continued Sonia, "especially with everything else you're doing, so just go at your own pace. There won't be a test, I promise."
"Thanks," Charlotte said, her grin not reflecting any intimidation. "So how did you get into magical pregnancies?" Leonard blurted suddenly, making Sonia and Will stare. "As a profession." Oh, come on. Was this an exciting new feature of his curse? Verbal clumsiness? Had he and the replicated sea life not suffered enough?
"I just sort of fell into it,"
she said, her southern accent somehow more lyrically musical than the Cajun voices he'd become accustomed to since moving to Louisiana.
"I mean, I was already interested in midwifery. It's sort of the family business, going back to my several times great-granny. She was one of those mountain women who cured what ailed you with a combination of real medicine, magic, and just enough power of suggestion to keep everybody in line. And then after my studies, I worked in a clinic where I just happened to have a patient who was a badger shifter married to a chupacabra."
Will shuddered.
"Wow."
"It took me a shameful amount of time to figure out I was dealing with two shapeshifters and how different that makes a pregnancy. Every shifter's gestation period is different. Their symptoms and cravings and complications are all unique. Anyway, once I put the context clues together, I was able to meet with them privately, let them know I was aware of their special genetic circumstances, and I would do everything I could to bring their babies safely into the world while protecting their secret. They were such a sweet couple. The daddy painted my trailer as a thank you. They were so happy with me that they contacted the local league office to tell them, assuming that the league appointed me to handle shifter pregnancies. The league liked what they heard and hired me as a freelancer. The more I worked, the more I learned. The more I learned, the more my skills were in demand. And now I'm here.
I'm so glad you're here, Leonard breathed. Across the room, Will covered a snicker with a cough. Sorry, ma'am.
Selky humor, Sonia said while giving Will an arch look.
Will sobered quickly. Which was her none-too-subtle way of telling you, I'm a Selkie, a seal shapeshifter. Other than increased strength and speed, it's really not an issue unless I'm near water, and even then I'll just outswim you.
He's exaggerating, Sonia insisted. He can also hold his breath for a very long time.
Will snorted.
So everybody just talks about their supernatural status in the open here? Charlotte asked. I've never worked in an environment like that, not even working with league clinics. It is considered rude by the locals to directly ask about magi status, but not to bring it up yourself. I, for instance, am human, Sonia said.
But with added awesomeness, Will insisted, while Sonia preened graciously. It would just be unfair to everybody else to give you superpowers. Charlotte looked to Leonard, who just couldn't seem to produce the words. I'm a human whose family has lived under a fairy curse for hundreds of years. It was the first time he'd had any trouble saying so while living there. When he didn't respond, she simply said,
I'm a Xana. It's sort of a broad-term catch-all for Romanian fey folk. My particular branch of the family were forest dwellers in the classic fairy godmother vein. They blessed unborn babies, helped lost children get out of the woods, rewarded decent people for their virtues, that sort of thing. Their affection for unborn humans eventually led to midwifery. My several times great-grandmother saw the writing on the wall in terms of the old world versus new, and how people were intruding on the forest. She adopted a common last name, learned human ways, and made her way to America in the 1830s. Somehow she ended up in Tennessee. It seemed a better long-term plan than cursing an entire population of woodcutters. She smiled warmly at Leonard, as if prompting him again to take his turn, but his mouth had turned dry, staring at her lovely little face. He swallowed heavily. It wasn't so much her fey nature, but the casual way she'd talked of throwing curses around made him nervous. Charlotte was an unknown quantity, and Leonard's reaction to that made him feel like a grade-A jackass. Her being born with special abilities was no more her fault than being born with a curse was his fault. Her being beautiful and interesting and kind had his hormones in overdrive, which was the real complication in the situation. He was practically tied in knots, he was so nervous. And that was never a good thing. He couldn't move, which was probably for the best, because he would probably trip if he tried to get up and fall out of the first-story window to his death. And even if he managed to make it out of the room unscathed, he didn't want to hurt this woman's feelings because of his own irrational issues. So he sat there, quietly, mulling over the possibility of time travel so he could go back to visit the O'Donnell ancestor that started this mess and kick his ass. Sonia apparently picked up on Leonard's inward meltdown because she quickly moved the agenda along to the next department head meeting. They chatted about the various departments and how Charlotte might need to interact with them. She was warned about Adam McTeague and his tendency to dominate meetings with his overblown opinions regarding his own economics research.
Leonard didn't contribute much to the conversation and was grateful to Sonia and Will for making up for his silence. As the conversation wound down, Sonia handed Charlotte a manila envelope.
"Now comes the thing that the League likes best."
"Paperwork?" Charlotte guessed.
"So many forms,"
Sonia told her in an almost apologetic fashion. "Most of them are very specific non-disclosure agreements. Don't feel like you have to get them all back to me today. Just finish them when you have time. And with that, Leonard and I will be on our way.
You two go make Mystic Bayou a healthier place."
Will grinned at her and gave her a smacking kiss. "Nice to meet you," Leonard told Charlotte before moving toward the door with near surgical concentration. She smiled and waved, probably trying to avoid another static shock. He turned to wave back, and somehow that motion threw him off balance and he tipped forward, nearly face-planting against the doorframe. Sonia caught his arm before his nose made contact with the metal.
"Are you all right?"
Charlotte cried, coming closer to cup his jaw in her hands, inspecting his face for damage. That same crackling energy rippled up the side of his face, making him shudder in dread and delight. "I'm fine," he muttered, stepping away from her. "Happens all the time." He walked out of the clinic as fast as he dared. Sonia only caught up with him halfway across the street. Everything would be fine. He just had to avoid beautiful, compelling Charlotte McBee, and he would be fine. Or at least, he wouldn't be injured in some humiliating fashion, possibly involving dragon fire or giant porcupine quills.
"You okay?"
Sonia asked as they walked back to the admin building.
"Sure.
I just hope that Jessica hasn't moved my desk into the swamp by the time we get back."
3. Charlotte. Whenever her mother got stressed, Lizzie McBee would say that she was blessed with work. Well, Charlotte had blessings coming out of her ears. Still, working kept her mind off of the thousands of moving-in tasks she needed to do. And then there was the strange riddle of Leonard O'Donnell. Charlotte saw him freeze up and shut down every time she approached him. Even if he was engaged in conversation, relaxed and laughing, he would just go quiet and still. He moved so rigidly, she was afraid his bones would crack. Some people just felt uneasy around the Fae. It was easy to understand, she supposed. Fae could be petty creatures, seeking disproportionate vengeance for relatively small slights. The Grimm's original fairy tales were practically subtitled long and detailed cautionary stories about pissing off the Fae. She tried not to let it hurt her feelings, but, well, it stung. And because her romantic nature was decidedly perverse, of course, she found Leonard incredibly attractive. Normally, she was a bit intimidated by men who were so much taller than her. But Leonard had the kindest eyes, with all the warmth and sweetness of melted chocolate. She found herself wondering what it would feel like to have those long, lean arms wrapped around her. In the middle of her work days, she would picture his large hands spanning across her back. And then she would start thinking about height, anatomical proportionality, and... No. She wouldn't date a man who didn't like her. She'd tried that. It didn't work. Well, honestly, she didn't date much. But somehow she always managed to choose men who were decidedly unavailable emotionally. It wasn't all that bad in the long run. She was an admitted workaholic, and her schedule was often filled with surprises and emergencies. She didn't have the time for someone looking for long-term commitment. Deep down, she wanted what her parents had, but she just hadn't found someone she thought she could tolerate forever and ever. Hank and Lizzie McBee had fallen in love at first sight, or at least intense like. At 20, Hank had taken one look at Lizzie and knew that she was it for him. Lizzie had been a little harder to convince,
unsure of how perfectly human Hank McBee would respond to her fey nature. The answer was, enthusiastically. They'd gotten married as soon as Lizzie's mother would allow it, after she finished her midwife training. And they never regretted settling down so young. They didn't see the point in dating other people when they found what they wanted on the first try. So, maybe, subconsciously, Charlotte picked men she could hold at a distance without regret. Somehow, she didn't think she could do that with Leonard O'Donnell. So, she distracted herself with patience. Jillian was coming in for an exam that morning. Anala Agarwal was expecting her exceedingly healthy tiger-slash-lion shifter baby any day now. Fortunately, it didn't involve complex magics fighting it out with each other. Just a lot of muscle and teeth. And she was sure Danny Teal was pregnant, but didn't realize it yet. Charlotte had come home from the grocery the day before to find Zed and Danny standing outside of the Silver Stork, a delighted curiosity burning in his gray eyes.
"Hi, Charlotte,"
he said, sheepishly taking her groceries out of her hands.
We weren't trying to look in your windows or anything.
He didn't mean for that to sound so creepy. He's way more interested in the engineering of the trailer than your underwear. Danny promised her, rubbing absently at her sternum, as if she was suffering heartburn. Charlotte's head tilted, listening to the tiny pattering sound only she could hear from Danny's middle. Between that and the lovely warm energy she could feel radiating from the witch, Charlotte could barely contain her giggle. This town was going to be so much fun. "Would you like to take a look inside?" Charlotte asked. Zed gave a nod more suited to a small child than a public figure the size of a boulder. She handed him the keys. "Go ahead."
"I'll just put these grocery bags on the counter," he said, fiddling the keys into the lock.
Once inside, he yelled,
"It's so girly inside, and everything smells so nice."
"We live in a man-made cave. It doesn't take much to impress him." Danny sighed, turning to Charlotte. "You sure you don't mind a stranger just going into your space like that?" Charlotte shrugged. The Silver Stork has served as an exam room, and once a birthing suite for a very tense manticore, so it's not exactly sacred personal space. I just keep the unmentionable stuff locked up. Considering the number of people who will be dropping by, that's a good idea. Danny stopped suddenly, turning a sickly shade of green. "Excuse me." Danny turned precisely 90 degrees away from Charlotte and vomited all over the blacktop. Charlotte poked her head inside the trailer and pulled a can of ginger ale she always kept on hand for her patients. Zed was engrossed in the overhead storage compartments, but when he heard retching noises outside, he moved towards the door. Or at least he tried to. Charlotte was standing in his way.
"Abay, you all right?"
he called, when he couldn't fit around Charlotte in the narrow corridor. "You might give her a minute," Charlotte whispered. "Nobody wants to be seen all vomity by the man they love."
"You sure?"
he frowned, craning his neck towards the windows. She nodded and took the soda outside, pressing it into Danny's hand. "Do you feel better now?" Danny nodded, her dark curls bouncing as she wiped at her mouth.
"I'm sure it's nothing. Food poisoning, maybe. I haven't felt right this morning since my breakfast pie."
And then she turned ghost white and said,
"Please never tell Siobhan I said that. If she thinks I'm blaming her for throwing up, she'll never let me near the pie again."
"My lips are sealed," Charlotte promised,